Voices of VR podcast.
Hello, my name is Ken Pai, and welcome to the Voices of VR podcast. It's a podcast that looks at the structures and forms of immersive storytelling and the future of spatial computing. You can support the podcast at patreon.com/voicesofvr. So continuing my coverage from Venice Immersive 2025, today's episode is with a piece called Collective Body, which is a piece that was in competition at Venice Immersive 2025. So this is a virtual reality installation that has multiplayer social dynamics. And so this is a piece by director Sarah Silverblatt-Busser. She's a classically and contemporary trained dancer and choreographer, and she wanted to counter the dissociation and depersonalization felt during the pandemic. And so she wanted to find new ways of moving your body that felt free in your movement, but also trying to tap into these authentic ways of moving. And so as you dance through this experience, there's these five different phases, and then you're having the movements of your body be categorized into one of the 16 different type of archetypes, which is the four elements and then the four phases on top of that. So there's these different types of elemental avatars that you get embodied with. And then you also have this social interactions with other people who have been classified by either the same or different types of ways that they're moving their body through a categorization of movement according to the elements. Okay, so the different conditional domains that are being explored here is that you're gaining deeper insight into your own self and identity, as well as through others, through this embodied movement and dance, but also through these various archetypal identities of the elements within the context of the cultural context. But there's also these kind of dynamics between the self and the other dialectics. And so one of the quotes they say is that, quote, meet ourselves and each other through movement. So the primary center of gravity of this piece is the earth element, lots of different embodied movements. As you're in this kind of New Mexico desert area, you are also in these avatars and moving and embodying through these different experiences. And so the avatars that you have are being chosen based upon how you're moving your body. And so you have more of like this abstract and symbolic quality to your avatar representation. So how you move is going to reflect back into the avatar that you're embodying, which is kind of cool to see that as a bit of a feedback loop. Although, you know, it's difficult because if you wanted to change that into a different element, then your avatar is not necessarily like adapting or changing. You're kind of fixed into, once you get classified, then you are then chosen for whatever avatar that you have for the rest of the experience. So it's designed to, quote, open us up to different sensations of our physical world while creating a new perception of ourselves as individuals within a collective. So that's the earth element as the primary center of gravity. The second center of gravity is the fire element. And so there's a lot of active presence and focus on movement and embodiment and improv as you're kind of moving through the space based upon the music and based upon your own creative expression of your will. And then through that, you are classified into your movements. And so the third elemental center of gravity is that air element. And so it's both the classifications of the archetypes of trying to discern these different potentialities of all the different possibilities for how you move. Here is the specific archetypal representations of that, and then also assigning you an avatar based upon that. But there's also this whole like kind of multiplayer social experience with the air elements, so the kind of social presence dimensions of that, where you're connecting to other people through your own movements. You get assigned this avatar, and there's basically a 4x4 set of different possibilities with the four elements and sort of like the four modes of the phases of matter, but also kind of musical ways of characterizing it. So listen to the interview to kind of dig into a little bit more of their typology, but essentially four major elements, and then within that four subcategories. And then the last is the water element in terms of the music. There is music that's very much driving through this experience, but it's much more driven by the overall embodied experiences in emergent social dynamics rather than having a specific narrative per se. But there are these processes where you go through these five distinct stages, these five processes that are broken up. And so in terms of the time dimension of the water element, here's how they're kind of structuring the overall experience. And so the first phase is around the beginning alone. So you're really discovering the world through your hands and your hands alone. And then the second phase is that you're discovering our first movements. And so you're learning how to take our first steps. And so you're moving in the steps and you're kind of tracing and having like little artifacts and traces of your step, almost like you're stepping in water and seeing the traces of that. And then the third phase is the first encounters. And so how do we learn to move with other people? And so you have other people that are starting to come into the mix. And by this point, you get categorized and you start to have these different avatar representations. And so then the fourth phase is find your authentic movement. How do we learn to reflect and find our own kind of movements? And then finally, the fifth and final is joyfully move together. How do we dance and join together with other people. So that's kind of like the structure of the processes that are unfolding within this piece. And then finally, the archetypal themes and the character that are being explored in this piece is that very much your movements and your agency and activity and your social dynamics that are kind of looking at these two. And so it's like looking at this individual versus collective journey. So, quote, collective body asks what it means to experience ourselves in relation to others without words and beneath the surface. How does a body hold histories over time? How do those histories get expressed and interpreted? And how do many bodies create their own ecology? So we're covering all that and more on today's episode of the Voices of VR podcast. So this interview with Sarah happened on Friday, August 29th, 2025 at Venice Immersive in Venice, Italy. So with that, let's go ahead and dive right in.
Hi, I'm Sarah Silverblatt-Bucer, and I am the director and creator of Collective Body. I also have worked a lot in motion capture for other pieces in XR. So I did La Petite Danseuse a couple years ago in augmented reality, and I also did the dance and choreography in Dance, 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 Matisse by Gordon and Agnès Mollier.
Nice, which is also here at Venice Immersive 2025. So congratulations on that. And I'm just wondering if you'd be willing to give a bit more context as to your background and your journey into working in the XR space.
So I come from a crossover between dance and sociology. I'm from the US and danced my whole life, but was also always fascinated in kind of the role of arts and culture at large. So I ended up studying both at the same time in New York. One of the classes that I took actually in my studies was in the religion department, and it was called Technology, Religion, and the Future. And it was one of those like blow your mind college courses where I got to try a headset for the first time in 2013 and was like, oh, wow, this makes my body feel really different. My mind feels really different. Like, what is the future of this technology? And in that same class, we were asking a lot of questions of, you know, what is the role of artists? We were reading Marshall McLuhan. We were reading a lot of really interesting, like Jaron Lanier. We were reading a lot of the big hitters in that world, and that was already in 2013. So that kind of planted a seed in terms of my interest in technology in general and how mediums can affect society in their own, how the medium can be the message, not always, but also questioning what is the role of artists and how can we say something about this technology, these different technologies that affect us individually and socially. And so, that's always kind of been interesting. And then in New York, I was working at several cultural institutions, always interested in kind of art tech pieces that would go through. I was working in artist services, so I was getting coffee for a lot of people, but I also got to see a lot of shows, so it was kind of like my research. And I saw Adrian M. and Claire B. bring a piece to New York in like 2015 that was super inspiring and exciting. And then at that point, I was at a crossroads of, do I continue in the arts or do I find something quote unquote more sustainable? And so I was like, okay, I'm going to really like push for it, and I really want to dance. And if I don't dance now, then like I'm going to do something totally different with my life. And I went full speed all in and ended up meeting a choreographer who's based in France named Johan Bourgeois, who subsequently invited me to move to France. I had auditioned for him and joined his company as a dancer. And one of the first pieces that I did with him was Fugue VR, which was directed by Michel Riac. So when I came, I was a dancer sort of mediator in that piece. And so I saw I was exposed already to a really great work of VR art and performance, essentially. And so through that piece, I got to go to a lot of different festivals, mostly circus-based, but other like immersive kind of environments. And so I got to see a lot of work. So always kind of researching and seeing what's out there. And then during COVID, my performing life stopped and everything went online. And we were talking about the metaverse. And I was like, oh my God, this is a little unnerving because, I mean, as a performer, as a mover, as a dancer, I live my life very much through my body. I experience the world very much through my body and other people's expressive bodies. And so I kind of had the seed for Collective Body during that time, feeling sort of separated from myself. I'm wondering, what is a virtual world? What is a virtual metaverse? Like, what does that mean if we're not bringing our embodied selves into that space? What if it, like, the rational mind, the intuitive body, how can we bring that intelligent body into that space also if we're only projecting? So that was part of the idea. I got really lucky and somebody connected me, Alexandrine, who had done Fugue VR at Small Bang at the time, connected me with Gordon for La Petite Danseuse, which was the AR piece. And that was the first time that I wore a motion capture outfit. So that was also like another big whoa moment where I saw my movements outside of my body and was like, oh, wow, this is like, I've known that movement speaks about our identity intuitively as a dancer, but to actually see my movement in a silhouette of Degas' Little Dancer, I still recognize myself. Like, I still can see that it's me through my hand movements or through how my gait, how I was walking. And so I was like, okay, what if I make something that allows us all to kind of extract our movement and live through a more concrete version of our movement, which is otherwise ephemeral, but something that does last, like, leave an impression. We see our friend walking towards us down the street, and we know that it's them from how they're carrying their body, how they're, you know, maybe curved over, how life has affected them physically. We recognize that. And so I wanted to make something that, yeah, that really kind of highlighted that other aspect of who we are that often gets ignored or sort of put to the side.
Yeah, I saw the La Hombre last night and then was talking to Jordana Lee and afterwards, and it sounds like that talking to her and then Lincoln Center, that she's been commissioning a lot of pieces and actually commissioned the piece that you're working on with the Collective Body. So just curious to hear a little bit more context for how the Lincoln Center came on board to your project.
So one of my many jobs that I had in New York as an artist, well, actually as a student, I had an internship with Jordana. So I was a public programming intern one summer and had like a really great connection. Meanwhile, always telling her like, oh, I have to go to my dance class. Oh, I have to go. Like, I was still pursuing dance 100%, but also kind of seeing the world of cultural institutions and seeing, oh, this can be a life. You can actually work in the arts and it can be something real, because my family doesn't come from the arts. So it was always like this thing that I got to do, but not a life, like métier, not like a career that I saw really tangible. So that made it tangible in a really important way. And then also seeing the role of arts in public society. I ended up working at Lincoln Center. So I was an intern and then I would do artist services throughout college. So I'd work a lot of events. And then when I moved to France, I was like, Jordana, I'm so terrified. And she's like, do it. And I was like, okay. She's like, stay in touch. And so then 3 years later, I had already been working on Collective Body. We had talked some, because she was starting to get interested in immersive work. She'd seen that I had done La Petite Danseuse and had asked me about it. And I had also taken a class during COVID at RISD on like basic intro AR coding. So I learned like Adobe Aero and I had done a little project around Cuba, and because I had studied abroad in Cuba, that I had shown her. So I was kind of like always sort of giving her things that I was working on. And then when Collective Body started to become more of something real in the sense that Atlas V had signed on, I was like, Jordan, I have something that I think would really be great. Can I pitch it to you and to your team? So often I go through New York on my way home to New Mexico. And so I was like, I'm going to be in New York. Can I pitch it? And she was like, yes, come. So I pitched it to her, to a colleague of hers. They really liked it. But then like 6 months later, I pitched it to her supervisor. Then 6 months later, they commissioned it. So it was a long process, but a really encouraging one. And also feeling very honored that it's one of the first immersive pieces that Lincoln Center has commissioned. So.
Nice. Yeah, I had a chance to play it a couple days ago and really quite enjoyed it in the sense that it was really inviting me to move my body in a way that was very playful, but also kind of reflective in a way of like paying attention to how I was moving and creating different avatars. And so it seems like it's kind of broken up to like five different phases or so. And so maybe you could describe the journey that you wanted to take people on.
So the five different stages that I imagined are based off of like five kind of major human psychology, human development stages. So like the birth stage, when you first come into the world and you use your hands to discover. When we're born, we don't see with our eyes very much, but touch is our first sense that's developed. So I wanted to start with touch and hands and reaching and exploring the world in that way. The second step is, I kind of in my head call independence. So that's when we first learn how to take our steps. There's kind of understanding depth perception, understanding speed, And so the second environment is about finding steps, finding rhythm, taking risks, and then combining that with our full bodies. So then there's other elements that come from the sky. So we learn how to use our whole body, our hands and our feet at the same time. And then there's kind of like that self-actualization phase. So that's when our avatar essentially gets formed. So the way that we've been moving in the first half of the experience actually describes and will define the avatar that you become. So that's, yeah, you put on your full self in a way at that point. The stage after that is meeting somebody for the first time. And so another stage in human development is learning through mimicry. So we're guided to mime each other, to kind of follow each other's movements, and then to eventually connect through synchronization. And then the last stage is society. So then we all come together and can share what, like, ourselves with each other. Yeah.
Yeah, and so maybe you could talk a bit about the initial user interactions that you're trying to guide people through with the hands and the hand movements, but then also like the stepping and the movement. It's an environment that is very sparse, feels like we're a bit in the desert, but also like having these symbolic things that are on the ground that are really inviting the user to incrementally move their body through space, but hopefully at some point along the way also find a bit of rhythm for moving in a more artistic or poetic way beyond just like the mechanical moving precisely to a certain spot, but really creating an invitation for people to move their body in new or novel ways.
Yeah, so the first interactions that we have are, there's kind of a sphere that forms. And I use music a lot and interactive sound. You know, of course, there are many iterations of this project. So one was very, very music heavy and very interactive music, which I ended up pulling back a bit from and relying a bit more on visuals. So the first environment, there's kind of this wind sphere that starts to kind of fly around you. And when you interact with it, it gives you beautiful little sound. So first you're taught to follow. And then eventually that wind sphere attaches to your hand. So now you're the one that's guiding it. So it's kind of like following somebody how to dance. And then now you've learned. And so now you get to dance with it yourself and lead the dance in a way. And all the while, it's kind of making a little musical feedback and a lot of sound design. So I work with Harvey Cawson, who is a composer in London, and Combe Jalibert, who is a fantastic sound designer, works in VR, and has touched a lot of projects here, I think. So a little shout out. The second environment then, so independence or stepping stage, you have one ring on the ground, and that's connected to lightning. So the environment is an homage, very abstract, but to my New Mexico background. So being in a desert, connecting to elements, to the texture of elements, to the behavior of elements, of wind, of rain, of lightning, all of that. And so the stepping stage is, there's lightning that happens, the ground sort of illuminates, and then you step on this first step and it gives you a musical note. And then you have two steps you can choose from. And so then it gives you different musical notes, and that multiplies and multiplies until then there's kind of these little fireflies that come down and dance around you, and you can interact with them and they attach to your hands. And so all of this also is very intentional to give the user a lot of freedom for themselves to feel free in their bodies, but also because there's a movement analysis system that does assign you 16 different avatars. And so I wanted people to be the least guided as possible, like the least choreographed, quote unquote, so that participants can really follow the intuition of their own bodies. So if they feel like going to the right every time, that's something that will potentially be described in the movement analysis. If they're jumping a lot, if they're going as fast as they can, all of that ultimately goes into the movement analysis that will then assign their avatar. So then let's see, the third stage is the kind of self-actualization when we discover our own avatar. And there's this really beautiful animation where we have almost an out-of-body experience. And then we're invited to dance with this 3D version of ourselves. It's in point cloud particles. It's very light. I wanted all of the avatar sensation to be as light as possible and as sort of formless as possible, because we all have very different morphologies. It's frustrating still, but the avatar that comes out of us is kind of it's androgynous in a way, but androgyny kind of leans often towards like masculine bodies. And so I was like, how can I get least gendered as possible? You know, I really wanted everything to be defined by movement and not so much by kind of superficial images. But so when we start dancing with this sort of point cloud avatar of ourselves, it starts to take form of an element. And so that element is what the movement analysis system has been defining over the course of the first half of the experience. And that element can be the ocean, if you moved kind of with big rhythmic movement. It can be snow if you were sort of slow and floating. It can be flames if you were really quick and brusque and changed rhythm. And so that tends to be a pretty fun moment. I had one of the tests that I did in Paris, somebody turned into lava. And they were like, wow, it was so meaningful because I have a lot of inflammation in my body, like autoimmune issues. And so it was actually really meaningful to see myself as this like fiery red version. And they gave themselves a hug of being like, it's okay, you can be a fiery, painful, angry body and I'll still love you. And I was like, wow, I had no idea that that kind of reaction would happen. But I mean, it's always interesting. That's what VR is really cool about, is it's so intimate. It can be very intimate. And then we open up to seeing one other person for the first time who's also now in their element avatar, or movement identity avatar is another way that I've called it. You are yourself as your avatar, and then you're guided to approach each other, to start mirroring each other. There are kind of magical lines that connect your hands. A lot of people have started holding hands at that moment and kind of dancing, swaying side to side, moving with each other. And then it opens up to the society scene. So now you see everybody in the experience. Here at Venice, we have 4 people, but we can go up to 8 people, potentially even 12 at a time, which is really exciting, just depending on the space. And so then you can really see the variation of people's movement quality and movement identity. And then it kind of turns into a celebration. It's joyful, light, and our avatars all sort of join together in this, like, I call it the disco ball, but it's like this colorful, happy, but also dense, living thing above us. And then it comes back down to the ground, and we can then change avatars. So now we can try how other people's movement identity feels on us, which is also the exciting part about VR, is that when we're wearing different avatars, it's a different sensation. It gives us a different sense of presence, I think. And then, yeah, and then it's just sort of this celebratory ending that has been really sweet to watch.
Yeah, as we're entering into the space, I'm entered in with 3 other people, so I know that they're in the same room, and they're, for the first part of the experience, I'm just in my own in the virtual space, and I don't see what they're doing. But eventually, like you said, in the later chapters, you start to be unveiled, these other dancers that are in the room, and they're being represented by the elements, earth, air, fire, water. You know, in each one of those elements, there's 4 variations, and so I was very watery and oceanic in my movement, in the sense I was trying to really keep moving and go backwards, but, you know, just try to make it interesting in the way that how it felt, not just the mechanics of, you know, stepping in the place, but try to make a flow between how to connect the dots on the floor. So this whole movement system and analysis is really quite interesting. I'm wondering if you'd be willing to describe, like, at the high level, there's 16 avatars, but basically 4 elements. In each of the 4 elements, there's 4 each. But if you could go through each of the earth, air, fire, water, how do you start to describe in language what those movements mean, and then what your process was to do the analysis of the movements to try to categorize how people are moving?
So the movement analysis system, I mean, I guess I can go back even further in that the original idea, I wanted it to be immediate avatar transformation, which is really hard. So when I was working with Ferdinand at Albion, we're like, well, what else can we do? Okay, what if it's something that, like, basically the avatar has to appear separately for us to be able to wear it? That immediate change is just really complex technically. So I had the opportunity, thanks to Lincoln Center, to have a prototype, pretty extensive test at Lincoln Center 2 years ago. We had 150 people come through the prototype, which was quite different at the time, but still allowed us to sort of understand different kinds of movement. And so for that, I had a lot of data. We captured where people moved in space, how quickly they moved in space, how their body position was. And this is all from the headset tracking. So it's full body tracking as much as possible. Pretty great what we've managed to do with the MetaQuest 3 headsets. And so, yeah, so I ended that residency with a lot of data, and I reached out to one of my best friends from college, actually, who's a data scientist. And I was like, can you help me make sense of this? Like, I want to figure out dance archetypal movement, essentially. So we worked together using different kinematics analysis, and then basically combining algorithms upon algorithms upon algorithms to define dance in a way of, like, I was like, well, I feel like dance is rhythm variation, space variation, and like body variation. And so then we were like, okay, let's break this down. So in order to make sense of that, my friend Kaya Cooper, then we realized that there are essentially 16 kinds of ways that people move using machine learning. That was our own little DIY system. So then from those 16, I was like, okay, how do I assign this to people's movement? Thinking of, you know, I had observed a lot, 150 people come through, so then how did I assign that to what I saw and what the data said? And my original artistic direction was more abstract expressionist and like color-based. And then I started to research a lot about color and realized, like, oh, wow, yellow means so many different things in so many different cultures. White, red, it can mean, you know, love and death at the same time. So I stepped back from using color, and that's when I switched to elements and kind of a natural environment as my artistic direction, and also wanted to do something that felt very as universal as it could. I mean, elements can also have a lot of symbolism, but I wanted to use them really as something concrete. We know how rain behaves. We know how the ocean behaves. We know the texture of snow and the quality of snow. So I thought that that was kind of the most concrete sort of descriptor that would hopefully relate to people. Like, yeah, and you were saying you're moving like the ocean, and so that maybe even, you know, has a direct memory that you can associate with how it feels to move in the ocean or how the ocean moves. So then the first environment describes the base categories, so that's earth, fire, air, and water. And then the second environment breaks those elements down into their state. So that's all dependent on body position. If you have your arms held out or close to you at the same time that you're maybe moving quickly or brusquely, how much rhythm variation you're doing. And so, like, for example, sand is somebody who has not moved very much because they've been categorized into the earth category twice, essentially. So it's grounded and grounded. And then, like, cyclone is somebody that's moved a lot, and they're also pretty expansive twice. So that's air and air, essentially. It can get kind of complicated. But, yeah, so essentially it's those four categories, and then they get broken down.
Yeah, the thing about the elements, I take a look at the elements and use them for my own inspiration of looking at different qualities of presence. So like fire element being active presence and water element being emotional presence and the earth element being embodied and environmental presence and the air element being mental and social presence. And so there's ways that you can draw upon the Hermetic tradition or other kind of associations. But at the core, elements are also broken down to hot and cold, wet and dry. So the hot is the fire and air, and the cold is earth and the water. And then there's breaking between wet and dry. So the dry would be the earth and the fire, and the wet would be the air and the water. So you can break it down and saying, like, hot and dry would be fire, cold and dry is earth, cold and wet is water, and hot and wet is air. But you can start to take these axes and look at different qualities of, like, hot and cold could be activity of how fast people are moving, how slow people are moving. And then for Chinese philosophy, there's the yang and the yin, and that matches up very nicely to the hot and the cold. So the hot being more yang energy and the cold being more yin energy. But there's not as clear metaphor for the wet and dry as other reference points. And so whenever you're taking the fundamental principles and expanding them out, then you can get a sense of these different qualities at even more of an elemental level. But I think people have their own experiences of the elements, and that you have a sense of what's it mean to move like air, more erratic perhaps, or with water, move fluid. So I guess there's always a challenge of trying to translate these qualitative aspects into language, but also into like these different categories. So it's very interesting and provocative for me to see that you've landed upon the elements and see how you kind of have this 16-part system. It seemed to be that for each of the elements that you have the four states, but for each of the elements, it's not always clear as how each of those four get broken up. So I'm just curious how you start to break those up into four additional ones.
Into the additional ones, yeah. Yeah, well, thanks for sharing what you just shared. That's also really interesting. So I break them up into, essentially, were they expansive and were they dynamic? So like a water element that is contracted body position and not dynamic is ice. And then the opposite of that would be ocean. And then there's the combination of being expansive and dynamic, that would be ocean, and then expansive and contracted, that's rain. And then, so each category has that combination of body position and dynamic or not dynamic.
Yeah, so just the way the hot, cold, wet, dry then gets split up in your own system, you're kind of splitting it up into kind of a fractal, 4 to 4 to get 16. So I consider the elements to be a little bit more of the universal archetypes in the way that people each have their own associations with those elements. And so they're very expansive in terms of how they can be used in different contexts. So yeah, I think it's a very interesting fit to be able to use that for the movement analysis. And so be curious to see how that continues to evolve or develop, or if people identify with that in the actual experience and notice that there is like an opportunity to kind of cycle through the different elements and to see how maybe your own movement would have this feedback loop cycle, so that when you see the element, then that kind of inspires you to move in a certain way. But also to see how when you're going from the individual to collective in the experience, you start to see them embodying these elemental avatars and seeing how they're moving. And so, yeah, it was interesting to see my own discovery of that through this movement analysis, but also to see the other people. And then from there, how we start to interact and play as a more of a collective body, as it were.
Yeah. I'm glad that you could have that experience. Yeah, and obviously, I mean, this is like my intuitive interpretation. It's how I feel ice is, how I feel the ocean is. It was interesting because I was working with our like lead art tech, and so we were making the 16 avatars, and he made ocean like all the waves, which I imagined ocean more as like this vast ocean. So even the ocean itself can be declined many, many times, or the rain itself can be a really light, nice rain, or it can be a heavy downpour. So, I mean, ultimately, you have to choose something and land on it and feel that's kind of the most appropriate. There are other like kind of esoteric movement analysis systems that exist that as dancers, a lot of us study. I don't know if we study it that much anymore, but something called Laban notation that is like hieroglyphics kind of, that I had studied in college also and didn't relate to it at all. And I was like, oh, this is so heady and like has these weird images that you have to memorize and nobody can understand them. And like, what is the purpose? I would much rather describe a dance with words than like have these symbols. I mean, there are words associated that are like qualitative that are kind of helpful, but at first I was like, oh, maybe I should use Laban notation. And then I was like, no, I want to do my own system. And this feels more intuitive and feels more likely that maybe the public can also have their own interpretation, which I wanted to make possible.
And as a dancer and choreographer, do you feel like you span all the elements and all 16? Or do you feel like you have a center of gravity of one or the other?
Oh, wow, what a question. I mean, as a dancer, we're trained to be able to embody all of them. I mean, if you're going to, you know, make it, you have to be able to take on different characters, different qualities. Ideally, a good single piece of choreography would probably span all of that. For me personally, as I'm walking down the street, I don't know, I guess I feel, I don't know, I think I feel probably oceanic. Maybe gas. Gas is a pretty good one because it's pretty active, but also like internally active, but also kind of calm on the outside. And I feel like that might be me. But also things change, you know, like you wake up tired in the morning, maybe in the evening you're more energetic. Yeah, that's a fun question though.
Well, you've created a system where you can watch people and make a judgment, qualitative judgment, how they're moving, but you've also systematized it into this more machine learning or data analysis, movement analysis, where the system is deciding what elemental archetype people are based upon their movements. And so I'm just curious if you've had a calibration process where you can start to understand what elements are likely going to come up, but then do the data science to see, and then you can do like the machine learning where you're labeling stuff to be able to tune it. But I'm just curious that process of your own qualitative assessments versus the system you've had, and if you feel like you're calibrated to both match what you would make in your own judgments, but also for you to make a prediction as to what it might decide based upon how people are moving.
Well, the analysis system is constantly retuning itself. So every time more people come through, we're getting more and more data. Then periodically with Ferdinand from Albion, we're kind of going through and like readjusting some of the pinpoints. So we're keeping it as alive as possible for sure. You know, the more data, the better essentially. And yeah, I mean, it's been pretty exciting to see people come out and feel like, oh yeah, I'm totally flames, or like I'm ocean, or maybe not. And that's okay too. I mean, it's an imperfect system. It's also reading movement in two scenes, which is a limited amount of time, and with specific prompts that are pretty free, but also specific to, you know, it's not just like following people for a day and seeing how they move throughout a whole day, which would probably be maybe more specific. So it's within a certain context. So I'm, you know, I'm flexible also in that it's an artistic interpretive piece and can let people have their own interpretation or not. And at the end, I mean, I gave that opportunity for people to try on other avatars because, you know, maybe it didn't feel representative and maybe you want to feel what ice feels, or maybe you, yeah, want to be like your neighbor, or yes. Also at the end, I have like the 16 cards, and so you can sort of learn a little bit more through words, not through the data itself, but in descriptive language. And that's been pretty fun to see people kind of look through and find what they were and then say that they were that or that they weren't, or like wanting to come back and try it again so that they can get a different card and like turn it into a Pokemon thing, which wasn't really the idea, but why not?
You got to collect them all, right?
Right. yeah. It's been fun.
Well, this is a very embodied piece in the sense that you're really creating an experience to get people really in tune to their own bodies. And so just curious to hear some of your reflections of as you're coming into the XR space as a dancer and really focused on embodiment. Just curious to hear some of your reflections on embodiment and the importance of embodiment when it comes to the larger field of XR.
Wow. Great big question. So for me, the interest in embodiment, I guess the crossover in terms of embodiment and XR and performance is the idea of presence. And in VR, we talk about presence, and I love your schema. But in performance, we talk about presence all the time, and particularly in the work that I do with Yoann Bourgeois, which is Nouveau Cirque. And so we're often bodies in kind of extreme circumstances, like platform spinning really, really fast or falling 4 meters from a heightened space. And so we're in control of our bodies, but we're not. And so how can we be really present? And that's paying attention to our sensations, or at least that's the sort of school of thought that we've been working in. So that's like feeling the lights on your skin and the warmth, and how does that make your body wake up a bit more? And then how do you feel present? And how does that communicate empathetically to the audience? And how do they then experience what you're experiencing? So in terms of my professional dance work, that's presence is like central, and so embodiment is central. Not even like technically dancing, but a being on stage that people can project themselves onto or feel something with. So that's something that I spent, you know, years working in and experiencing firsthand, and then doing like jumping into VR spaces and reading books, and they all talk about presence. It's like the key, or at least some of the intro books, you know, it's like presence, and what does it mean to be present, and what are the tricks to feel more present, and that's using your body. So like I remember during COVID, I came across this MIT like PhD paper on embodiment in VR, and it said walking is one of the main tricks or tools that convinces you that you're in a space. And I was like, oh, that's really interesting. Like, so we aren't just our brains. We can't just be virtual, rational beings. If we want to actually think that we're somewhere else, we have to engage our body. And so that's also kind of like the seed of the project and of my interest. I appreciate very much solo VR cinematic experiences, but I don't imagine myself, maybe, who knows, but I don't imagine myself in that world, because I think that the point of VR for me is that we can have our whole selves in this experience. And for me, our whole self includes our body and our intelligent body. You know, there's The Body Keeps the Score, which was this big book that got super popular a couple of years ago that I think some people question, but largely, you know, the body-mind connection is pretty well respected at this point, and the body and mind are enmeshed, they're not separate. And so VR is a really exciting way that we can value that and kind of flip things around and center the body. And I mean, that's also a gendered thing, you know, of like the intuitive body, and that tends to be more gendered. And so how can that also have importance in this space? And even like we're kind of doing, I mean, I studied sociology, so I observe these things, but like in the piece, people who feel more comfortable immediately, people who don't feel more comfortable immediately, like some of that's gendered and like, but I mean, that's a whole other thing that I'm not going into.
Yeah, and just in terms of the presence, Mel Slater wrote a paper back in 2009 or so, and he had established what he called the place illusion and the plausibility illusion. So the place illusion that you're in another place even though you're not, and the plausibility illusion is that your mind thinks it's real even though it's not. And so a lot of the presence research has been illusionary, where it's like focused on this, you're in a virtual space but you're not actually in that space, you're in a physical reality. But I feel like there's, you know, from my own approach, I prefer more of a phenomenological or relational approach, where it's not emphasizing the material reality versus like more of a experiential reality. Well, specifically, if you think about it as a good example, like social presence, they'll call it the co-presence illusion. Well, it's like, okay, well, you could just say social, like you feel present with other people. Like you can think about other contexts, like a telephone. When you talk to someone on the telephone, you don't come off saying, oh, I had a illusionary conversation with somebody. Well, no, the conversation was real. I have real relationships with the other people. So it's more about your relationship to the other symbols or people that are being represented. So that's one way that I get away from this kind of illusionary language. But Slater also talks around the virtual body ownership illusion, which is that you feel like you are embodying this avatar and you identify with it even though you know that you're not actually there. There is the place illusion and the virtual body ownership illusion, which I think of as more the earth element, air element, the plausibility, and also the social elements, the abstractions of language and communicating, and then the water element, the emotions, and then the fire element, the active presence or agency. So these qualities of presence are all tied in there, but the body ends up being the center point for so much of it, as well as your sensory experience, and your body and mind are taking into all these different qualities of presence. And so anyway, I feel like your piece is really focusing on this kind of embodiment and creating the social dynamics of embodiment as well, on this piece that's really emphasizing moving your body through space, which I think is a real key part of the VR medium. And it's like the simple instructions that allow you to drop into your body in a unique or novel way, and also the opportunity to kind of find your own unique movements and the way that you move through space, but being able to measure that and assign you an elemental avatar, which I think is, yeah, I just really enjoyed it. And I feel like it's an experience that made me feel even more embodied at the end of it.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah, what you were saying, you're talking about phenomenology. So Merleau-Ponty and his phenomenology of perception is definitely something that's super interesting to me, and how he talks about the body as the medium in the way that we experience the world and how the world experiences us. So that, yeah, I it's cool. Yeah. Oh, I'm glad that you had a good time. That's cool.
Great. Well, I know this was commissioned by the Lincoln Center. Is this the world premiere here, or has it shown elsewhere before?
This is the world premiere, and I was like freaking out 4 days ago, and so I feel so joyful and happy and moved to see how wonderful the responses have been. After this, we go to Japan, actually, in like a week and a half, which is kind of wild. So I'm an associate artist or accompanied artist at the Center of the Arts in Enghien-les-Bains, which is just outside of Paris. And we had a couple residencies there that allowed us to do multi-user tests, which is, we didn't get into that, but that's a whole complex aspect of VR creation. So they're doing a presentation of their season, and we were included in that, and it's in relation to the World's Fair in Osaka, so we'll be there for 10 days. And then we come back, and then we have a premiere, like a preview-ish in Enghien-les-Bains, so just outside of Paris, and then Lincoln Center October 22nd to November 1st, and that will be the big full version, so we'll have likely up to 8 people at a time in the experience, and I'm really excited for it to be in New York audiences, which are really diverse, exciting audiences. And then from there, we're hoping that it can live anywhere and everywhere, and we've had some great responses here, so feeling hopeful.
Well, it sounds like your dance card is filled for the immediate term, for the next couple months, but looking to continue to travel it around. You're also featured as a choreographer in the Dance Dance Matisse. I saw you were being featured in the artist statement of that video, which was nice to see you pop up there as well. Maybe you could say a few words on working on that project.
Sure. So Gordon and I have worked together now on 4 projects. One other recent project that we were presenting last week, actually, in the middle of Germany at the Ruhr Channel, is called Rave El Party, and it's a concert performance around Ravel. We did a lot of motion capture, et cetera. But during that process, Gordon was also making, with Agnes, was also making the Dance, Dance, Dance piece. And we just love working together. And he was like, hey, we want some dance scenes in Dance, Dance, Dance. And they know that I have a pretty wide dance vocabulary. And so they wanted to have something that could be both kind of representational of the era of Matisse, of dance from the era of Matisse, but also something contemporary. So we did a week-long creative period where I made the choreography, and La Danse has five different dancers in it, in the painting. And so we have them living in this other space. There's a moment in the piece where they talk about Matisse seeing dancers do the farandole, which is a traditional French dance. And so I created that dance, essentially, each of the five dancers, which is a challenge to dance with yourself while you're not actually there. So I had to do myself in five different spaces at the same rhythm, moving in space in a circle without running over myself, which was a fun challenge. And so that's kind of like a dance sort of that era. And then there's a scene later when they're talking about Matisse and his influence on us today. And that is more of my, I guess, sort of typical dance that's more contemporary. And so I did, I guess, like eight different characters, contemporary dance styles that I brought in that are the cutouts, that represent the cutouts. And yeah, it's just a joy to work with Gordon. I mean, it was doing La Petite Danseuse that I first did motion capture and was like, wow, what is this body out of myself experience, movement, gesture? So it's thanks to Gordon also for a lot of this, for sure.
Nice. What was it like for you to watch a piece like Matisse, and when you see your body, like motion capture moving, and you like cloned in multiple versions of it? Because, you know, you can probably watch, you know, you've obviously as a dancer, you watch videos of yourself, but now to have a full spatial experience, to almost like an out of body experience of watching yourself perform.
Yeah, it's really wild. I mean, it depends on the different kinds of motion capture. So when we did Little Dancer, La Petite Danseuse, we had my hands really well tracked, which was great because also the character was dancing, but she was also just kind of, I was acting in a way. So it was more of my like daily gestures. So that was really like, wow, that really is me. This other one for Matisse, it's a little bit more general, the tracking. And so, I mean, for me, I'm, you know, exigeant in terms of like my dance technique. And so sometimes motion capture, you know, your legs are turned in or your feet aren't pointed as much. Or so sometimes that's the first thing I see. And then I get past that and I'm like, oh, wow, okay, this is actually really lovely how they put it all together. And it's fun. I mean, yeah, the dancers are different shapes. They have different morphologies. So that's kind of fascinating to see me in different sizes. And then to go to the cutouts, which we did in front of a green screen. So that's just more me, like it, that's my body. But yeah, it's fun. It's weird. It's like a little trippy. It's also exciting to imagine what else motion capture can do. So in the Ravel piece, I become a robot. And that's pretty fun.
Nice. Is there any way that all this XR work and dance feeds back into other interests or concerns around sociology that you may still have?
Yeah, I think, I mean, in terms of like community, for sure, it comes back because I think technology is so present, especially in young people's lives. And I think it's an interesting and exciting way to create new forms of access to the arts, like dance or to Matisse or to even feeling yourself moving and feeling good about movement, like you were describing earlier. So for me, there's definitely a component of what does it mean to see ourselves not in front of a filter, like a Snapchat filter or an Instagram filter, where there's a lot of like, I don't know if it's like dysmorphia exactly, but to an extent of like, you know, especially young girls, adolescent girls. I mean, I was one at one point, of like, how does your body fit into this standard? So for me, it's exciting also to say, oh, we can also exist in these other ways that doesn't have to be Kim Kardashian or fill in the blank. So I guess that would be maybe like a kind of sociological, psychological approach to the, for me, what's exciting about these kinds of technologies. Yeah.
Great. And finally, what do you think the ultimate potential of virtual reality and dance and storytelling might be, and what am I be able to enable?
I think it's a great storytelling tool. So I think that there's a lot that we can use. Sometimes I get really tired of having a headset on my face. So I think I'll probably go in and out of that world of using headsets or other kinds of immersive technology. I definitely like, yeah, projections and screens and motion capture for sure. It's, I mean, yeah, the limits are, we're just getting started, which is also what's so exciting about this space is it feels very fertile and it feels very experimental and open to experimentation. I think, yeah, really great theatrical tools. Seeing Blur was super exciting to see how we can mix realities. Collective Body, at one point I wanted it to end in mixed reality. I thought that would be kind of fun, but I decided to keep us in that space ultimately until the end. But, oh yeah, I mean, lots to explore still for sure.
Is there anything else that's left unsaid or any final thoughts that you'd like to share with the broader immersive community?
Don't forget to move. I don't know. No, thank you. I just feel so grateful to be here in Venice. I'm really grateful to Liz and Michelle. Thank you, Kent, for taking the time. It's been really inspiring, this conversation. Just a lot of gratitude. I love the XR world because it's very, yeah, it feels welcoming in a certain way that's cool and exciting and inspiring and feels like connective. Like there's just a lot that can happen.
Yeah, well, I really enjoyed the Collective Body, where it feels like this individual to collective dance ritual and kind of discovery of movement identity process that you've created. And that, yeah, just the way that you're able to kind of architect these simple movements that then kind of coalesce into this larger journey that you're taking people on through these five different stages. And so, yeah, just really enjoyed the piece and looking forward to having more people have a chance to try it out. And yeah, and maybe also continue to refine this kind of elemental approach to movement in a way that kind of leans upon other traditions of the elements from across different cultures, kind of leaning upon some of the different existing language and ideas that are there and see how that gets translated into different movements. So I know there's like five element dance and like other traditions that have already started to do that a little bit, but to see this translation into the system is an interesting feedback to start to systematize it in some way and, yeah, add some data science and analysis and also reflection to see if people really identify with these different elements and different avatars. So, yeah, excited to see how it continues to develop and for more people to get a chance to try it out. So thanks again for joining me here on the podcast to help break it all down.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for tuning into this Venice Immersive 2025 coverage, and hopefully you found some use in some of this documentation of these experiences that are very ephemeral. And some of these show at these festivals, and they don't really go out widely beyond this a lot of times. I mean, maybe they are, but you may not be in a place that it's easy for you to see them. And so it's a real privilege to be able to see all these experiences, but also to be able to sit down with these creators and have a really deep, in-depth conversation in a way that there are not a lot of other opportunities to really dig into at this level. And so I really appreciate all the time from all the creators to be able to have these conversations, but also for you to take the time to listen to them. And also it's been a challenge of trying to find a way of speaking about these experiences in an abstract, theoretical way, or at least in a way that I can ground it and allow you to put yourself into the experiences to kind of imagine some of these different things that they're doing, how I'm experiencing it, but also the different types of design decisions that the creator is making. So if you find this useful and want to support this type of effort of both documenting the history of immersive storytelling, but also to support this kind of wildly ambitious independent journalism project that is very much driven by support by listeners like yourself. So please do consider becoming a member of the Patreon at patreon.com/voicesofvr. Thanks for listening.